The Asian Classics Institute presents Lojung, Developing the Good Heart, with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in June of 1998. This is the beginning of Class 7.
Okay, we'll start. I'm sorry for the confusion. Okay. We'll start, okay? Last time we were halfway through the Lojong called Freedom from Four Attachments, and we're going to go ahead and continue that one, all right? We finished Chen Dila Shena Chepa Min. Say, Chen Dila?
Chen
Dila. Woo. Shena?
Shena.
Woo. Chepa Min.
Chepa Min.
That's nice. Okay. Chen Dila means this life. By the way, if you're a real Lojunger, you don't mind the heat, right? Just put up with it, okay? Who cares? Shena means if you're attached to this life, Chepa Min, you're no Dharma person. And I think it's very, very important that we don't carry our Judeo-Christian baggage to our Buddhism, you know? You don't have to feel guilty or sinful about drinking a nice milkshake. You don't have to feel bad about seeing a good movie. If you see a bad movie, I think you should feel bad, okay? And you don't have to feel bad about Neil Young and stuff like that, okay? But Porter said, nah. Okay. Not like that, okay? Real attachment to this life, we talked about it last time. As far as your, what you choose, your ethics, you know, what you choose to do, that's the important thing. And your ethics have to be driven not by attachment to this life, but by your intelligence, by your wisdom and your knowledge of karma and emptiness, okay? So forget doing good things because you always did them, because you were a good boy at school, okay? Forget doing good things because your school teachers told you that was good or that was bad. And forget doing good things because of what your parents taught you. Forget doing good things because of what you heard at church or what you didn't hear at church. Forget doing good things because of what your culture says, which changes every year or two. Okay? Forget it doing good things because of what your peers think. Okay? Because that will change as you get older also. Okay? Every year it goes by, that changes. Okay? You need to learn not to have attachment for those things. You have to do what's good because of the laws of karma and emptiness, okay? And a lot of that overlaps with what you learned in school. I'd say, you know, 80% of it overlaps. And what you learned elsewhere about what's right and what's wrong. The other 20% is very delicate. okay? The other 20% is very important. It's very important to realize that what you do is right or wrong, not because there is some person keeping track, because there is no person keeping track. What you do that's right or wrong has to only be driven by what's bad karma and what's good karma. What will hurt other people and yourself in the future? What will keep you in this world? What will keep you in the condition of dying? Okay, that should be your decision. You know, what keeps you and the people around you in the condition of getting old and dying? According to Buddhism, this world is a mistake. And to live in this world is an error. It was a mistake that you got here. It's a boo-boo to be here. And if you live in this realm the way you were born in this realm, if you're not a deity, okay, I don't know, there's probably a few hidden here, all right? But if you are who you seem to be, you came to this realm because of some negativity in your mind, and that will kill you. You know, that will make you get old and die. And you will lose every good thing you ever find in this realm, okay? And you have to try to figure it out before you die. And you have to change realms before you die. Okay, and that's your morality has to be driven by that and that alone. Okay, and oftentimes what you heard earlier in your life is wrong according to that standard. You know, it will not protect you from dying. It will not get you out of this realm. It doesn't even talk about things like that. You see what I mean? Not at all. So your whole personal standard of how you live your life as a Buddhist and as a Lojong person, forget what you ever heard in your life. You know, go after the things that will get you out of this realm, that will get you out of death. And they really do take you to a thing called heaven. You really can go to a thing called paradise. But there isn't any system that exists in your Western culture that does that right now. And you have to learn it and you have to get good at it. And you don't have much time. So to be attached to what you heard before, to be attached to what your family is saying, your teacher said, your culture said, they didn't talk like this. They're not getting you ready for that. You didn't get the information there, okay? And you have to not be attached to what you knew before. You have to start thinking for yourself. The second part of that, which I didn't cover last time, is te sam gom sum. Say te sam gom. Te sam gom. Te means learning. But religious learning, spiritual learning, okay? That decision too has to be made now independently. You have to think for yourself. You have to find a path that works in this lifetime. And you have to do it only because it works and not because somebody else said something. You see what I mean? Each person in this room is going to die. Each person in this room has very little time to do something. Each person in this room is surrounded by other people who are dying. You personally have to figure out what's going on and you have to do something about it. And you have to decide what path is going to work. And you have to be very critical, even of what you hear in this room. You know, you have to decide for yourself what you hear in this room and elsewhere. Is it going to help you to escape death and suffering? You know, will it help you or not? And you have to be totally critical, even of what you hear in this room. You have to say, I'll check that out. You know, I hear him talking. But it doesn't matter if I'm up here saying it, or somebody else, or some great lama, or it doesn't matter who. You have to be very critical. Your life is at stake. Your happiness is at stake. You have to decide what makes sense, what works. Who's talking about dying? Who's offering something to fix it? You know, and you have to, attachment to this life in this Lojong means your spiritual practice has to be a personal spiritual journey that runs off of your own free decisions and thinking. And you have to give up attachment for what you heard before. Even what I say, even what a person says, you have to be very critical of it. You have to decide for yourself what's right or wrong. There's a bodhisattva vow that says you break the vow if you're attracted to the teacher and not to the teaching. You see what I mean? Like, you don't accept the teaching just because the guy looks convincing, or he's nice, or he seems to be a good person, or he seems to speak well, or something like that. Forget it. does the message work? You know, does what the person says work, no matter who gets up and says it? You see what I mean? It's a mistake to be attached to or attracted to a person and not be attracted to what they're saying. And you have to judge for yourself if what the person is saying is correct or not. And the only way to find out is to try it. And does it stop your suffering? You know, does it change your life? Does it change your world? And you, everything has to be like that. Dharpa Gyaltsen is saying, Holy Lama Dharpa Gyaltsen is saying, you can't be attached to anything, even Buddhism. You have to check it out. You have to be very critical. You have to check out what the person's saying, and not just because it's this Lama or that Lama. You have to, everything is at stake. Your life is at stake. You know, you will have to examine everything they teach, and you should do only the things that you find to be logical and the things that check with your experience. Okay? And not because you're attracted to the person, but rather to the teaching. Okay? That's to some gom. You meditate on those things. Your whole idea of the way to spend your life. How many hours do you give to meditation? You know, students often come to me and say, is 45 minutes okay? I don't have an hour. Or is 30 minutes okay? I don't have 45 minutes. Forget it. I mean, frankly, you need 2-3 hours a day. Maybe 5 hours a day. I don't know. And you should stop once a year, 3 or 4 times, and go into a month's meditation, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to mislead you. Probably you do need 2-3 hours a day, okay? You can't do it in a normal job. I know. I worked a normal job for 16 years, you know, I know. You have to make a deal, you know. You have to be a businessman, a real businessman, you know, a meditation businessman. You have to go and, you know, I always tell people, keep the job you have now, and then go find a job where you can responsibly spend half the day working on your spiritual life, because you probably need that much. And you're going to have to do with less, and that's okay. It actually helps your spiritual life if you have no money, okay, or little. You know, it's actually more, it's very conducive to spiritual life. It's not a problem for a person to have less things. Because some part of your mind is always keeping an inventory, right? 2% of your mind, you know, is worried about what possessions you have. Where are they? If I ask you, where is your car right now? Is it parked on the right side of the street? No, those of you who own cars have to keep that in your mind, or you get a $100 ticket. I know I got one, okay? 130, okay? And that takes up a certain percentage of your mind. And then the more possessions you have, the more things like that, you see? So, you know, if you ask me where my car is, I say, I don't have a car, you know? I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to remember which side of the street it's parked on. You know, and things like that, you know? So it's not a problem to have a... Maybe the priorities of this world are wrong. Probably they are, okay? Maybe the priorities of American culture are wrong. Maybe spending 8 hours a day is wrong. Maybe spending 50 weeks a year, 98%, 96% of your life working, and 4% on what you want to do. You know, does it really take 96% of your time to have 4% of your time back? I mean, is that a good deal? You know what I mean? Is that a good business deal? You know, I don't know. They get you to work in business and they don't teach you to think like a businessman, you know. Is it fair to... Is it good business? Is it a good deal to give $96 to get $4 back? You see what I mean? Is it a good deal to give 96% of your time to feed yourself so you can have 4% of your time back? It doesn't seem to make sense, you know, and I don't think you really need to do it. You have to evaluate your life like that. Maybe the priorities are wrong. If you are already practicing Dharma, maybe your priorities are wrong also. There's a thing in the Bodhisattva vows. In the Bodhisattva vows, you break the vow if there's 2 spiritual activities to do and you choose the one that helps less people. You see what I mean? It's very interesting. There's a Bodhisattva vow against prioritizing your good deeds wrong. You know, obviously if you have a choice between doing a bad deed and a good deed, I hope most people in this room will choose the good deed, right? But now, once you're into the Dharma, Dharpa Gyaltsen is saying, you have attachment to this life. If you don't choose the Dharma which is more powerful, you know, if you have a choice between, say, a bodhisattva activity and a non-bodhisattva activity. You have to go for the one that helps more people. Okay? And I think 90% of us who try to practice Dharma are lazy because we are attracted to this life. And I don't mean milkshakes. I mean the way of thinking of this life. It's easy to give up milkshakes. It's easy to put on robes. It's easy to go stay in a room and not have a family. You know, that's easy. But to try to not be attached to the thinking that you grew up with, that's what it really means. You know, to not be attached to the deal that your culture is offering you, Western civilization, to not be attached to that, is to give that up is a lot harder. You know, to recognize that that doesn't work is a lot harder. Putting on robes, you know, agreeing not to drink alcohol, agreeing not to have a family, that's easy. That's no problem. And that doesn't necessarily get you liberated by itself. You know, it's can you not be attached to the way of thinking that your whole civilization has been doing for hundreds of years? You know, can you change? Can you break off? Can you break off your attachment to that way of thinking? You know, that's very difficult, you know, because it's all around you all the time. And if you don't, you will die. You see? According to Buddhism, if you don't break your attachment to that, you will die. And even if you're practicing well, you must prioritize the practice right. If you have taken empowerments, you must concentrate on that. You know, you must concentrate on that. If you've taken Kirim and Dzogrim activities, once you've mastered Kirim, you must go for Dzogrim, you know, or you're wasting your time. It's the same as choosing the worldly life as opposed to the spiritual life. You see, at every stage you go in your spiritual career, you have to keep going higher. And you see a lot of people, most people never get into a spiritual path. But those who get into it sometimes get stuck on the lower spiritual path. You know what I mean? They get attached to this life in the form of practices which are easy, and they ignore the practices which are difficult, you know, or which take more faith or more courage. And at each point you have to face those decisions. And as much as you gave up the ideas of your civilization, of Western culture, then when you get into the Buddhist Dharma, you have to move up the scale of ideas until you reach the highest ideas of Tantra, okay? Frankly, okay? And you must go for it. You don't have time, okay? If you want to do it in this lifetime, before you die, if you want to actually change your body and your mind into an enlightened being in this lifetime, you have to give up the lower, more comfortable practices as easy as you would give up the New York Times standard of living. You see what I mean? And that takes courage. And that takes independent thinking. And that's what he's saying. Don't be attached to this life in the form of what they taught you. And don't be attached to this life in the form of, you know, doing lower things that are more comfortable when you have the strength and you're ready to go on to higher things. Okay? And be willing to give your time for those things, even at the expense of lesser virtues. You see? Once you get into the virtue business, you have to go after big-time virtue. Okay, that's the point. I tell the story of my boss. We started this company, three people. We started a company with three people. And he got offers from these jewelry stores. He does diamonds, right? We do diamonds. And he got offers to sell diamonds, like $10,000 worth of diamonds. So I said, well, should I go? And he said, it's just down the street. And he said, no, don't go. I said, are you crazy? You know, we had $50,000 at the time. I said, it's a $10,000 deal. He says, I refuse to do a deal under $50,000. You know, every single deal I do should be over $50,000. And he made a rule, first day, you know, we can't deal with small, you know, what do you call it? Small change. You know, he said, we got to go for the big time. You know, I will not deal with a company that cannot give me a $50,000 order in one shot. You know, now we have a $150 million a year company, 900 employees. He's still doing the same thing, you see? And that's the way it goes, you know. You have to, in the virtue business too, there's lots of good things to do, and you have to be willing to give up the lesser things for the higher things. At each stage in your career, in your spiritual career, you can't rest on what's comfortable. You know, you have to go on. You have to go higher. When you're ready, okay, too early would make you fail and would make you give up everything. But when you're ready, you have to keep going up. It's the same decision that you made when you came to this class and you rejected the ideas of your civilization. Now, within the Dharma, you can't be attached either. And that's what he's saying. That finishes the first of the four. Okay? We were supposed to be there last week. Second one says this. A person who is still attached to the three worlds has no renunciation. We're going to talk about what the three worlds means. When Drapa Gyaltsen gets to this line, he says, this is talking about the three kinds of pain. And the first pain he defines this way. Say, Nyantong? Sum. Nyantong? Sum. He's talking about the idea that being attached to the three realms is to be attached to the three kinds of pain. Okay? There are three kinds of pain, three kinds of suffering. First one is called the pain of pain. Okay? Outright pain, obvious pain. Say, Dungyal?
Dungyal.
Ki?
Ki?
Dungyal.
Dungyal
ki?
Dungyal.
It's called the pain of pain. Okay? Obvious pain. The definition in the scriptures is a backache or a headache. Okay? That's called Dungyal ki Dungyal. First kind of pain. Drapa Gyaltsen, Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen defines it as Nyen Song Sum. Say Nyen Song
Sum.
Okay. Nyen means lousy, bad. Song means went there. Sum means three. Okay? This is the Tibetan word for the three lower realms. Okay? This is the Tibetan word for the three lower realms. In the Tibetan tradition, especially Lam Rim teachings, I'm supposed to go into a long lecture about the sufferings of the hell realms and the sufferings of the hungry ghosts or the tormented spirits and the sufferings of animals. Okay? Two of those three you can't see. Okay? I'm supposed to give this long description about something you can't see and you cannot confirm. And you're already suspicious about one of them because they fed you that in Catholic school and you gave up the idea of hell. You don't want to hear about hell. You don't like to hear about hell. You know, I had people in California actually threw something at me when I started talking about hell. Okay? Like, not supposed to talk about it, okay? And Buddhism teaches there are hells, okay? Hot hells, cold hells, certain levels, all sorts of... If you've ever read the Inferno, it reads just like that. It's just the same, okay? It's very, very similar to Dante's description of hell. Tormented spirits is not hard to imagine, but I can't prove it to you. Beings who, because they were cheap and stingy and unhelpful to others in their past lives, and because they were very attached to money or houses or cars or their possessions, that after they died, their spirits are tormented. And they're almost like ghosts who travel around and can't get enough of anything. So you can meet that kind of personality in this life. You can meet human beings who, you know, I remember my boss, when he made his first million, he split it up with all of us. You know, we all got a little bit of it, you know, very little. But anyway, you know, and then when he got his second, we got another bonus, but it was slightly smaller. And then when he got to 10 million, it was like tiny. And when he got to 100 million, there was nothing, you know. And this is like some kind of hungry ghost mentality, you know. And that's, you can see it in human beings. Some, you know, people have even said, oh, they're not really such beings. This just refers to the mentality of that stinginess, you know, of getting worse and worse the more money you have, usually. Okay, it's not metaphorical. There are beings like that. Okay, I just got through asking you to be critical, even of what I said. You should be sitting there and saying, maybe yes, maybe no. I never saw them. Okay? Hell, same thing. Maybe it's there, maybe it's not. I don't trust you if you don't think that way. Because next week somebody will get up here and tell you the opposite, and for the same unthinking reasons, you'll accept it. Okay? You should be critical. You should say, I don't know. Maybe there's a hell, maybe there's not. Maybe there's a hungry ghost, maybe there's not. Past lives? Maybe yes, maybe no. Okay, Kedup J. Jetsun Kapa's one of his best disciples, his tantric master disciple. He wrote this book and he said, all the Tibetan people believe in past lives. I haven't met one who could explain to me why they exist. Okay, they just believe it because their parents told them that. They don't understand it at all. He says, I don't want Buddhists like that around me. You know what I mean? Okay, so I'm not trying to, make you buy the three lower realms. Okay, you can see animals. I think it's more interesting to talk about, could you become one of them? You know, it's much more interesting for me to talk about the possibility of becoming one. What does it mean to become an animal? Okay, how could you become a roach? I mean, was Kafka right or not? You know, you just wake up one morning and you're a roach, or how does it work? You know what I mean? Could it happen to me? And I love this question. And to me, if you talk about this, then you don't have to talk about the three lower realms. Okay? Attachment to the three realms means attached to pain. And pain is the three lower realms. You don't want to go there. If they exist, you want to keep your rear end out of them. Right? Now, do they exist or not? That's the question we have to talk about. I want to read you a... You're going to get tonight an addition to your past reading. And I want to show you one part of it. Where is that? I was going to write the whole verse on the board, but then Tessie would try to memorize it, and she'd be all strung out all week. So I thought I'd just read it to you, okay? Yevar korki shibe dole. And this is a very famous sutra. It's the sutra by Upali, requested by Upali. If you studied in the Sri Lankan tradition and things like that, Upali is a very popular figure. Okay. Semnyal jigpa ngai ten che ne, semchen tonda duma kyo ke kyang, kangda shipa ngendrung drak dowe, dowa deda namyang yomayin. Okay. Translate it for you. This to me is probably the most important quotation in Buddhism. Okay. It's from a sutra. Accepted by all Buddhist schools. Lord Buddha is speaking in the sutra, okay, and he says the following. And you're going to get it in your reading, so don't worry too much about it. When I taught you of the terrors of the realms of hell, many thousands of those among you were frightened and dismayed. But I tell you now that those people who die and travel to these terrible realms of pain don't even exist at all. Okay? That's his first opening lines, you know. I taught you about hell and you all freaked out. But now I'm telling you, the people who go to hell don't even exist. Typical Shakyamuni Buddha, okay? Okay. Next verse. This is a lung, okay? Kangda rautin da chen sin jin be, nepa chepa yepa mayin te, tope wangi ngen son terana, lula bap tong dena, there is no one to hurt you, no one to cut you with a sword, no one to thrust a spear through your body. Everything that you see happening to you within these realms of terror is only a projection. There are no instruments of pain there. Okay? So he's saying, when you go to hell, you do get your body chopped up. And the thing about hell, just so for your information, okay, you can't die. There's a problem dying there. I mean, if you could get your body cut up and die, it'd be all right. One of the karmas of being in hell is that no matter how badly you get cut or burned, you can't die. Okay? You keep feeling it. The feeling never stops. And your body just keeps regenerating itself. Okay? Then he goes on to say, everything there is a projection. Everything there is a projection. There are no instruments of pain there, he says. Okay, last verse. Nato yiga meto kaje ching, serke kang chop bawa yuon wa. Dina delang chepu ga meto, de da topi wang shabayin, topi wang jikten nam tak te. Okay, translated. Flowers blossom in a rainbow of pleasing, elegant blooms. Mighty structures crafted of pure gold steal your heart away. But here too, no one ever came and stopped to do construction. All of these were also built by the single act of projection. Then is the punchline, okay? The whole world is but a creation that comes from your projections, okay? And that is used in Madhyamika, that is used in the highest school of Buddhism to describe the lower realms. This is how Jetsun Kapa describes the lower realms. He says, no problem, it's your projection, okay? That's my last word on hell, okay? I'm not going to go through describing to you how the dogs with iron fangs chase you up trees of knives, which is true, okay? It's a projection, no problem, right? The, It is a problem because it's a projection. Okay? Got it? That's what I wanted you to get in that mood. Okay? If Acme Construction Company went down underground below Utah somewhere and built hell, you know, that's silly. That sounds crazy to me. If you say there's a beautiful, all-loving God in the sky and he has a special box where he sends bad kids and girls to go and he makes them, he tortures them down there if they ate meat on Fridays or something like that, then you could say, that's silly to me. I don't buy it, you know. Now you have Buddha saying, don't worry about hell. It's just a projection, okay? And actually, he's trying to make you feel worse, okay? He's trying to convince you why they do exist, okay? A Buddhist would say this. Somebody asked me, does hell exist? I say, yes. Do you know for sure? Did you see one? No. Well, then how do you know it exists? Because everything's a projection, okay? So hell exists. Hell is very, very real. Hell does exist. Hell is not a metaphor. Okay? Why? Everything, he says, the whole world is but a creation that comes from your projections. Everything around you is a projection of your own mind. Okay? We talked about it. We had it, you know, the famous thing. Okay? What is this? Nobody who's Central Park can answer. What is this? That's true. I can't deny it. What is it? Come on. It's a pen, right? The kids taught us that, right? Where's Sammy? Where is he? Sammy, what's that? Huh? Oh. He said a chewable thing, right? Smart kid. Okay, the adults here who don't know anything would say, that's a pen. You have a pen in your hand. And Sammy, because he went to Sunday school that we had on Saturday, said, that's a chewable object. That's something to chew on. Okay? And we taught it in the children's class. We had it in children's class. Okay? I can hold this up and you'll say it's a pen. But in reality, what is it? It's a blue and white cylinder. And you can't deny that. It's a blue and white cylinder. Okay? If you happen to be a human sitting in a chair here, you'll say, that blue and white cylinder is a pen. Okay? If a dog walks in here, Rob has this great dog, we checked it out. All she wants to do is chew this thing. Okay? She does not cognize it as a pen. She does not have a conception of it as a pen. To her, this is a blue and white cylinder, which is something very fun to chew on. Okay? And that's all. Who's right? The human or the dog? Both. Okay? Equally valid. Okay? You can't say ultimately that it's either one. Okay? There is no ultimately anything. Okay? You can say validly it's a chewable thing. Or you can say validly it's a pen. I saw this neat ad on Houston. There's a lady dressed in on a building, huge. One of those things you use for a seat cover. Automotive, yeah, I don't know what you call them. And it says, from fashion to automobiles. So she's wearing this automobile thing on her as a dress. And the point is that it's functioning as both, you see? It's one thing, if you look at the picture one way, it's something to put on your car seat. If you look at it the other way, it's something to wear. You see, and how you see it only depends on your mind, right? What mode you're in. Later. So how you see this cylinder only depends on your mind. That's the emptiness of this cylinder. Okay, get used to it. That's the emptiness of this cylinder. From a dog's point of view, it is validly something to chew on. From a human point of view, it is validly a pen. It is ultimately neither. It is independently neither. It is from its own side, neither. It is self-existently neither. It is by nature neither. Okay? It is both, depending on who's looking at it, okay? It is one or the other, depending on who's looking at it. But from its own side, it is empty or blank. And that's the meaning of emptiness. Every object in your life is the same. Every single object in your world is the same. Your head is the same. Your nose is the same. Your ear is the same. Your mind is the same. New York City is the same. The sun is the same. Okay? Everything is the same as this pen. What it is only depends on how you look at it, how your mind's looking at it. Okay? The only other thing to say is, do you have a choice how you see it?
Yes.
Not really. Okay, I mean, a dog comes in here, no matter how much we wish, the dog is not going to pick it up and write you a letter. Okay? Can't. They don't. They are being forced by some kind of energy, some kind of power is forcing them to see it as something to chew on. Bring a human in here, most humans, they're not going to like spend an hour chewing on it, I mean, at just to chew on it, you know? Because their mind is forcing them to see it as a pen. The word forcing is very important, okay? According to Buddhism, that's your past karma forcing you to see it one way or the other, okay? It is empty from its own side. You are perceiving it one way or another, but you are being forced to do that by your past karma. You don't have a choice, okay? You can meet a person coming into the Quaker house that you don't like, and you really don't like them, and they seem to be hurting you, and they are, okay? That's real. Your mind is forcing you to see the person that way. Buddhism doesn't say they're not a bad person. They are a bad person from your point of view, okay? But if you watch television, every time some guy shoots 10 people and they interview his mother, it's like, no, not my son. He couldn't have done that, you know? She's being forced to perceive the son differently, right? She's honestly, sincerely doesn't see him as a mass murderer, you know? And that's valid. She's seeing it that way, okay? She's being forced by her relationship to see him that way. And it's the same with every object in the world, okay? It's the same with heaven and it's the same with hell. And that's what the scripture means, okay? The raw material, the world around you is raw material for heaven or for hell, or for a little bit of mix of both called human realm, the human world, okay? The same raw material, the same white and blue cylinder can be something wonderful, something terrible, or a mix of both, okay? And you're experiencing it as a mix of both right now, okay? If you straightened up your karma, you would be seeing it as something wonderful. If you're sloppy with your karma, the event of death will trigger new perceptions of this same raw material as what? As hell. Okay? If hell is a projection of your mind, you're in trouble. Then hell is possible. You know, your heart told you when you were 12 years old that it's unlikely that an all-loving being would go down underground and work so hard to build this big box to torture people. Okay? Doesn't make sense. But if I say, this little room here, now it's lucky we got put underground, okay? This little room here that you perceive as a basement in the Quaker house, you could perceive as a chamber in hell. Really? If your mind perception shifted slightly. Slightly. How long does it take? About 3 minutes. Okay? And I'm not kidding. It's the same. If you believe what I said about the pen, you must eventually accept that you could perceive this room as a hell chamber and be burnt here for years and years. Okay? You have to accept that if you accept what I said about the pen. Going to hell is no big deal. You do not take a hell body. That's bad. That's a bad way to say it. Your perception shifts slightly and the same place becomes a hell. And I'm not talking a metaphorical hell. I'm talking a real one. Okay? You can go to hell and it takes about 3 minutes and it's a shift in your perceptions and we're all eligible. And it will be forced on you. Now hell becomes very serious, you know. And hungry ghosts, things like that, they do exist. You don't go there, your mind shifts. Okay? It wasn't built by a construction company, says Lord Buddha. It's a projection. Now you're talking something real. Now you're talking something dangerous. Now you're talking somewhere you and I can go in 3 minutes. You know, don't want to do that, okay? By the way, what does going there mean? Your perceptions shift, okay? They just shift slightly. You know they can shift in 5 minutes. You can go from not knowing you had breast cancer to knowing you have breast cancer in 1 minute, right? It takes 1 minute for that shift to happen. Don't think you're not eligible for it. Of course you're eligible for that. It takes 1 minute to go from a healthy guy skating down this street to the last accident where some car hit him and he's like broken his legs and now he can't think anymore, or something like that. You know, I mean, that's how the world happens. It's a shift of your perceptions. You didn't get hit by a car. It was a shift, it was a slight shift of perceptions. It happens in a minute. It happens in 3 minutes. You could be in, you will be in another realm within 3 minutes after you die by the nature of all things. By the thing that makes this a pen, you can go to hell 3 minutes after you die. You don't want that. Okay? I mean, I don't want any person in this room going to hell. Okay? You've got no excuse to go to hell. Okay? You really don't. You know everything you need to know. You must stay out of that. You must go beyond that. Okay? There's a certain stage called Dzolam Supa in your understanding of emptiness. If you get there, you cannot be born in a hell. If you reach that spiritual level, it's impossible to take a lower birth. And I hate the word take a lower birth. I mean for your mind to shift into a lower birth. What makes an animal? What makes a dog a dog? Because he looks like a dog to a human? That's what you're always thinking, right? Externally, independently, from his own side, he looks like a dog, so he's a dog. That's not what makes a dog a dog. A dog is a dog because a dog sees a chewable thing when I hold this up. And that's all a dog is, you see? To say you can take birth as a dog 3 minutes from the time you die only means 3 minutes from the time you die you can start seeing this as something to chew on. And that's what makes a dog a dog. That's what a dog is. It's a collection of experiences. It's a collection of perceptions. It's not something furry. It's something which sees its skin as furry to itself. And that's what makes a dog a dog. We can become dogs in 3 minutes. That's all. Now it's possible to go to a lower realm. I don't have to stand up here. I hate it when they stand up here and describe, oh, this is this such and such a spear they poke you with, or such and such a fire they burn you with. It's all self-existent. Go to the Buddha. Go to the Sutra. Okay, he said it's all a projection. Now you're in trouble. You know, if it was made by some construction company, we could all giggle when they talk about hell. If you say it's your perception the same way this room is your perception now, then you're in trouble. Then you've got to do something about it. You know what I mean? Then you really have to do something. Okay? And he says, don't be attached to your idea that this world cannot change. Okay? That's the second kind of attachment. Nobody should have it anymore. Okay? How do you stay out of hell? Keep your vows. Keep your book. Okay? There's a method. It is taught in the highest tantric teachings. You know, people always come to me, show me this tantric book. I had this person this morning. I heard about Kali Devi. I heard about Mahakala. Can you show me the book? You know, and I'm like, no, I can't show you the book. I can tell you openly the highest secrets of Tantra. 6 times a day, stop and check your vows. Okay? That is the highest tantric practice. Okay? Sorry. It's not what they said at the Learning Annex, okay? I saw that one. Sound pretty hot. It's stopping every 2 hours and checking your vows. That keeps your rear end out of the lower realms, okay? You can't have those perceptions if you keep those vows, okay? If you don't know what they are, now I get to do an advertisement. Come on Monday night, okay? We're going to discuss them this Monday at 7 o'clock at 6th Street, okay? Those of you who wish can take the first level of vows the following Monday, okay? So if you haven't taken refuge vows, or if you haven't taken layperson's vows, and if you're interested in it, come on Monday, okay? 7 o'clock on this Monday. And then the following Monday at 7 o'clock, there'll be a ceremony for taking them, okay? If you take a vow to do certain kinds of karma, and you do them, it's extremely powerful. Okay? You may be doing the same kinds of karma without taking the vow, but it's not as powerful. So it's very good if you take a vow. Okay, so come and see, check it out. Okay? It's no obligation. You can always not come back the second Monday. Alright? Check it out on Monday night. We're gonna go over the refuge, what it means to take refuge and what the commitments are. And then the following week, you're welcome to come. Those of you who have taken refuge already, and if you have, then you've got a special name, a special religious name, or if you've taken lifetime vows of a lay person, then you're welcome to come, but you cannot take the vows again. Those are lifetime vows. You get them once, and that's it. Okay? We're not allowed to take them again, because it would actually destroy the first one. Okay? So, I mean, bodhisattva vows and tantric vows you can renew. Layman's vows, lifetime vows, are lifetime vows. You take them once and that's it. Does that mean you can't come 2 Mondays from now? No, of course you should come. It's very holy to watch people take vows. I always cry. It's so beautiful to watch people take vows. Okay, it's very, very sweet to watch somebody get their rear end out of hell. You know, and it's sweet to watch, so you're welcome to come even if you're not going to take them. And you're welcome to come on Monday even if you took them already and you kind of secretly want to find out what you agreed to do that you never heard about. Like you can pretend you know it all. And I know I've met a lot of people who took refuge and had no idea that they had 12 separate commitments. Okay, and it's nice to know what they are. If you keep them, you will not have that dog's projection or that hell beings projection. That's all. That keeps you out of those places. That's what they're for. That's the function. That's what they do. Okay? And it's very cool. Otherwise you're eligible for those things. You really are. Okay. Okay. I'm just gonna give you the names of the three lower realms. Yeah. Yeah, there is a typo here. I'm sorry. This should be Ngenso. Okay. Lungsom Sum would mean the three ducks, okay? We'll do Ngenso Sum. Okay. Aura gives it to me to check every night, and I'm usually asleep by then. So. Say Dundro.
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 Dundro
means animal. Okay. First of the three lower realms. Where are the three lower realms? Are they lower? Where are they? It's on the homework, okay? Where are they? They're in a sense, they're in your mind, you see? When there is even a school of Buddhism that when they read this scripture, they decided that the whole world exists within your brain. They're called the mind-only school. Okay? Later on, it was proven that they were wrong. It's not true to say that the whole world exists only in your brain. That's not exactly true. Things do exist outside of you. People have asked me, you know, how do I know everybody else in this room? If everything's a projection, then how do I know there even exist other people? The Buddha said they do exist, okay? I mean, there are people around you, and it is your projection, okay? There are hells, and it is your projection. They are real, because they are your projection. Buddhism says things are real because they're a projection. You see, anybody else would say things are unreal because they're only your projection. We say things are real because they're your projection. Okay? You really can go to hell because it just requires a shift in your mind. Okay? Does that mean the whole world is just one person's mind? No. Okay? And you have to get used to that. Okay, so can I prove it? That's another story. Okay. Say yidat.
Yidat.
Yidat. Take a small tendency towards selfishness in the mind. Magnify it millions of times through the process of death and the bardo. And it would create projections called hungry growth or spirit, like some kind of tormented spirit. There do exist these beings. Okay? According to scripture, they have physical bodies which are too subtle to see. You cannot see their physical bodies. Okay? But they do exist around us. Say Nyelwa.
Nyelwa.
Nyelwa means a hell realm. Hell. Okay. I'm not going to talk a long time about hell. A couple of features. In the Abhidharma Kosha, third chapter, an important thing to say about the hell realms is that time slows down. The perception of time slows down. A day in the hell realms seems like thousands of years on this on the top of the planet. You know what I mean? Time slows down. Because time is a perception also. So they really do last for a very, very long time. Christianity says you go to hell once and you stay there forever. It's almost right. Okay? I mean, according to Buddhism, you stay there for a very, very, very long time. And the rationale is that time slows down. You see what I mean? Your perception of time slows down. When you're having a good time with somebody, the whole night can pass quickly. Okay? When you're having a headache and it's 4 o'clock at work, that last hour seems to last a day. Okay? And it's the same principle. Okay? They go on for a very long time. And again, you cannot die. Okay? Things that would normally kill you don't kill you. And you're conscious all the time. There is no, in the lowest hells, there's no other feeling than pain. You never have any other feeling. Okay? I wanted to put up for you the, on your homework it says, name the sutra where the Buddha said all this stuff is only your projection. Okay. Say nyewar, korki, shube, do. Okay, nyewar kor means upali. It's a popular monk's name in the Pali-speaking Buddhist, you know, the Pali-writing Buddhist countries, Sri Lanka. Rinpoche and I stayed in a Sri Lankan monastery for 6 months once, and the youngest monk was named Upali, so all the other ones were always saying, Upali! Meaning, get your rear end over here and cook dinner, you know, like he was lowest on the totem pole. Poor guy. Okay. Upali. Ki means by Upali. Shubha means requested. And do means sutra. Anybody ask you, where did Michael Roach get this idea about projections and all that stuff? Why does he teach emptiness like that? You can say, oh, it's from the sutta requested by Upali. It's a quotation from Lord Buddha. Okay, and it's in your reading for tonight. You're going to get that at the break. I would live with that quotation. It was the most exciting moment of my 18 years of monastic study, the day that they taught that. I'll never forget it. Most amazing moment, you know. Everything made sense. At that moment, the whole world made sense to me. Everything made sense to me. Emptiness made sense to me. Karma made sense to me. You know, to me, it's the most stunning piece of scripture you can find. You know, the whole world is that. This room could be a tantric paradise and will be. This room could be hell and might be. I hope not. I really hope not. You have to take vows, okay? And this room could be a plain old mix of both, which is what it is now, which is miserable. Okay? And it's your choice, you see? It's all your choice. It's always your choice to create the causes for it to be one or the other. Okay? The next kind of suffering he talks about is the suffering of change. Okay? It's called the suffering of change. It comes under attachment to the three realms. By the way, don't mix up the three realms and the three lower realms, okay? In the reading it says, don't be attached to the three realms. That means anywhere in this world, okay? There are three realms called desire realm, form realm, and formless realm. You can't see the other two realms. We are living in the desire realm, okay? The lowest part of the desire realm is called the three lower realms, okay? So don't mix up the three realms and the three lower realms, okay? Tonight we've been talking about the three lower realms, okay? But even if you could come back and be born as a human, it's no good. Why? Suffering of change, okay? Suffering of change. Suffering of change means, this is, people ask me, what made you a Buddhist? I tell them it was my high school girlfriends, okay? I mean, if it's a newspaper, I say it was my mother's death, okay? Among friends, I say it was my high school girlfriends, okay? They say, why? I said, really, it was wonderful. It was happy. It was the most important thing in my life. It was just great. Something special. Something extraordinary. And it always changed. You know, it always changed. Nobody stays the same. Nothing stays the same. No relationship stays the same. It always, for me, always got worse. Okay? I don't know about you. But it always just, at the best it changed into neutral or something kind of boring. At the worst it was like you started hating each other after a while. Okay, why? You know, I was trying to decide, and it happened with my parents. You know, I watched them get divorced, nasty divorce, screaming at each other all the time. I knew they loved each other, you know. So why is this going on? Why? Why do people change, you see? And I was feeling bad. I was feeling guilty, you know. Oh, I must be a bad person or something. Then I began to discover that everyone does that, you know, or almost everyone, okay? And I began to wonder why. Or why is it that you get something that you're really hoping for, this piece of clothing, or you're really hoping for this guy or this girl, or you're really hoping to get this job, or you're really hoping to get this position, or you're really hoping to learn this language or something. And then after a while, it doesn't make you happy anymore. After you get it, right? Worst thing that can happen is to get it, right? You get it, and then after 6 weeks, it doesn't feel so great anymore, you know? And what is it in the human being that makes that happen? Suffering of change. It's called the suffering of change, okay? What is really happening? You see, is that lady changing? Is that man changing? Is that position at work changing? Is that amount of salary changing? Or is something else changing? You see, I mean, after a while you realize, you get to a certain maturity as a person living through this life, and you say, they're not changing, it's me. You know? You start to realize it's you, okay? The reason that the relationship you have and the people that you're in relationships with always seem to get worse, or something seems to go worse, often seems to go bad. And even jobs you get that you were dying to get, and then after you get them 6 months later, you're dying to get out of it. You know, a level of money that you thought would be enough for you, and then after you got it, after 6 weeks, you're dissatisfied again. It's the demon of dissatisfaction. You know, why do things keep changing? Why do we always want more? Are they changing? No. It's a shift in your karma. It's a shift in your mind. Okay? That's the suffering of change. Okay? And in this realm, you cannot avoid it. Okay? As long as you decide to live here this way, nothing will make you happy. Guaranteed. Okay? The whole world is getting up at 6 o'clock and taking a shower and shaving and putting on those terrible work clothes. Most uncomfortable. I don't know why they choose them. And then going through the whole day struggling to get something. And if you got it, it wouldn't make you happy anyway. It's the curse of humanity, right? This is the suffering of change. Your own mind will make you dislike it within another 2 months, okay? If you get all the things you dream for, you will be unhappy again within 2 months. This is the curse of our karma, okay? The thing did not change. It's still $86,000, you know what I mean? The salary you were hoping for, the magic number, right? Next, 6 months later, you want more, okay? It doesn't seem like enough anymore. The 86 didn't change. It was your mind, okay? Oh, well, could we just learn to be satisfied? No, you can't. It's a curse of your mind. Your karma is shifting. Karma, what we call dirty karma, dirty good karma, shifts all the time, okay? You can pretend to be happy, but you're not. You're not really. If someone else, if your friend was making 96, you wouldn't be happy. If everybody in the office was making 96, you wouldn't be happy. You see, it's not ultimate. The mind keeps wanting more, okay? It's the nature of your mind. It's the nature of your karma. Any good thing you get in this world without an understanding of karma and emptiness must make you unhappy, period. Must turn into something which makes you unhappy. And it's, so I was like relieved to find out it wasn't my fault. You know, it's like, okay, that's the way karma works, okay? And it is the way karma works. And you shouldn't stay here. It's no fun to stay there. It's no fun to see things constantly get worse. Every time you get something you're hoping for, it gets worse. You know, it's no fun anymore. Learn how to stop it. And that's keeping your vows. And using an understanding of the emptiness we talked about. Okay? Learn how to manipulate your reality in the future. Yourself. Homemade reality. Okay? I would rather be in a world where things don't work that way. Well, if you don't like it, you change it. Okay? Start keeping your vows. Okay, do some powerful karma with the perfection of wisdom, which means it won't change. You see what I mean? It won't change. Yeah. He says, isn't it your fault because it's your karma? Of course it's your fault because it's your karma. But there's two kinds of karma. I'm talking good karma, right? There's what we call sakche ki le and sakme ki le. Say sakche.
Sakme.
Sakme.
Sakche.
Sakme.
Sakme.
Sakche is nice things you do and you don't know what's going on. And they, in the future, will bring you a karmic result which is nice but which wears out. Where? In your mind. Okay? The reason your body's getting old is that that old good karma is wearing out. Okay? Your body's not getting old. It's your perceptions are changing. Okay? You can change that. You don't have to live like that because there's sakme. Say sakme.
Sakme.
Sakme means good karma which is everlasting. You see what I mean? If you collect good karma with a certain kind of knowledge, you could change bodies. You don't have to be in a body like that. Okay? Big difference. You have to learn between good karma which is dirty and good karma which is pure. Impure good karma and pure good karma. And the difference is the perfection of wisdom. It's understanding emptiness. Okay? Yeah?
I have a cat and I really love the cat. I know it's going to die, but I've never not loved the cat.
Yeah.
Oh,
the reason to get enlightened is so that you can love the cat and it won't die. You see what I mean? It's correct to love the cat. And it's good to love things. You know what I mean? It really is good. By the way, if your perceptions don't change and you continue to love the cat, it will die anyway. You see what I mean? And then it became misery. You see, even in cases where you don't start to hate the person, they die. I mean, in the rare occasions where they do their 50th wedding anniversary, still loving each other, one of them dies, you see? And that's what I'm talking about. Every good thing changes to bad in that sense, okay? But you don't have to live like that. If you collected karma differently, you could change that. And that's what this class is about, okay? That's what this whole lojong is about. Okay. Last two... Well, I'll take some questions. Go ahead.
How is this pain any different?
The one here?
This change, this pain.
He said, like, I think your question is this. The fact that everything good in this realm tends to screw up.
And you can't get enough.
Yeah, and you're constantly tortured by not being able to get enough. How does that differ from a hungry ghost realm? I mean, qualitatively, it's the same. It's exactly the same state of mind. Quantitatively, they go through much worse suffering. It's much, much more painful. Okay? That's all. And it lasts longer. Okay? Yeah.
Well, this is true, the prasangika thought. If I had the karma to see the Christian thought as the correct way to be, and then I broke the ethics of it, meat or whatever, would my karma force me to have rejection to see me in a Christian hell, my rebirth?
Okay, this is a little complicated. That's complicated. He said, if I had the karma to be a Christian, for example, and then I had the karma to receive Christian teachings on hell, and then I had the karma to receive teachings that if I did a certain bad deed, like eating the wrong thing on the wrong day, and then would that cause me to perceive myself as entering a Christian hell, the Christian version of hell? I would say yes. I'd say that's possible. Yeah. Because 90% of what occurs to you is from your motivation. You see what I mean? If it's your motivation to hurt something or to be harmful to another person, it almost doesn't matter what you do. You see, some people hoping to kill someone accidentally help somebody. From the point of, in Buddhism, we say that the motivation is 90% of the karma, because the karma is collected in the mind. You see, it's an imprint in the mind. So the motivation is what makes that imprint, more than the external reality. You see what I mean? More than who shoots the gun or what the bullet hits or anything else. It's what were you thinking when you pulled the trigger. You see what I mean? That determines the strength of the karma. So, yeah, I would say that if you... That's a difficult question. I mean, if someone told you, for example, there's a real case in the Abhidhamma Kosha. There is a non-Buddhist Hindu teaching that if you meditated your whole life and then get up on this ladder and set a spear down below, you know, with the face up, and you jump on it the right way, it's a trident. And if one goes through here, and one goes through here, and one goes through here, and if you die like that, you reach nirvana. You don't have to go through all this suffering. And the Abhidharma says, is this a good deed or a bad deed? You see, because according to Buddhism, this is the most stupid thing you can do. It's the most ridiculous thing you can do, to hurt your precious human body to reach a spiritual goal. The Abhidharma says that the motivation is a great virtue. You see, from the point of view of motivation, they truly want to achieve nirvana. They're tired of this constant change into suffering, suffering or change. They really want to change it. That's a beautiful, wonderful motivation. So from the point of view of motivation, good karma, and will lead them to a good result. From the point of view of execution, extremely stupid, extremely bad karma will lead them to very bad karmic results. Okay, and it's the same thing. Okay, one more question, then we got.
Since they're all individual projections, these realms.
Yeah.
Do they match? I mean, this two people see the same thing.
Yeah. Bill said, well, since they're all individual projections, do any two people ever perceive any two objects the same? It's a good question. Okay, like, do any two people ever perceive this room exactly the same? Buddhism says the following. Everybody in this room tonight has collected in the past a karma of providing other people with a place to have their Dharma teachings. Every person in this room in the past, according to Buddhism, did something to help other people have a place to have their teachings. And that's why you enjoy the use of the basement, the lousy basement of the Quaker house, okay? No, but at least you're having a class, right? It's uncomfortable, okay? But the fact that you're here proves that you personally did something to help other people have a place to study Dharma, period. So we're all having a common or a shared projection of a room in which a Dharma teaching is going on. Do any two people in this room experience it exactly the same? No. Okay? I mean, your feelings, your emotions, how much of this teaching is important to you, all of that is different. Each person's having a different karma. But the fact that we're in a room and having a Dharma teaching is a karma. We together did something to help other people learn Dharma. And because of that action, we are having a Dharma class together. Okay, and that is what this room is, and this room is nothing more than those projections going on together. Got it? There's no room independent of the collective projection of a room. There is no basement in the Quaker house. There's 100-something people having the same projection of a room in a Quaker house. And that's why we can't have classes here next semester. Okay? Because that karma is wearing out. Seriously, okay? Those projections are going to wear out simultaneously. And then we can say that this group doesn't have a place to have a teaching next time. And that's true, okay? All right. Last thing, then we'll take a break, okay? He said we could go over a touch tonight because it took us so long to find a room. You'll get to a line where Drapa Gelson speaks of the mystic power of this good deed. Okay, and it says, what good deed is he referring to? Where does its power come from? And how could it enlighten all beings? Okay. What is the basic good deed of the Lojong at all? What's the main good deed of a Lojong person? Stop worrying about yourself and worry about other people. I mean, that's the lesson of the Lojong. For me, this class has been very, very much like a breath of fresh air, you know? You know, every time I think about it, every time I wake up and I don't open my eyes and I think about what can I do today to destroy my main enemy, which is worrying about myself, it just frees me. It makes me happy. I'm happy like for a whole 20 minutes or so. You know, I mean, it's like, it really feels good. It really feels nice. I mean, the enemy of Lojong is worrying about yourself and not thinking about other people. And what the mystic power of that, and he's talking about the desire, in this case, that the pain of other people could come to you and they wouldn't have to experience it. Okay, we talked about it as being a death lojong. At the moment of your death, in the moment of your death, as you die, do this lojong. I take all the pain of other people in me. May I die with it. Let it die with me. Okay, I'm about to die. And don't forget it, okay? I'm about to die. It's going to hurt. At least let me take other people's pain away from them as I die. That's what he calls a mystical action. like an ultimate mystical action. Does that get other people enlightened? Question. It's on your homework. No. You can't take away their pain. Okay? You didn't collect their bad karma. They did. Where is the bad karma? In their mind. How do you get bad karma out of somebody's mind and get it into your mind? Like special scalpel or something? You can't do it. Prove it. We wouldn't be here. I would not be here standing here in this hot room if the Buddha had taken away my bad karma. Of course the Buddha would love to take away my bad karma. At least the Dalai Lama, okay? I don't know if the Buddha was there or not. I know His Holiness is here. And I know, I believe, seeing His face, feeling how I feel in His presence, if He could do it, I wouldn't be having a hot room right now. If He could take away my bad karma, I'm sure He would have done. I believe Ken Rinpoche would have taken away my bad karma. I lived with him my whole adult life. I truly believe that if it was possible for a high lama or a Buddha to take away my bad karma, he would have done it a long time ago. I'm still having bad days. I had a headache this morning. It was really bad, okay? Ergo, proves they can't take away your bad karma, okay? Can't do it, okay? So what's the mystical power of this great deed? It gets you enlightened, okay? It gets you enlightened faster if you want to take other people's pain away. If you really want to do it, it makes you a Buddha faster. And then you can teach them how to do it. And that makes them a Buddha faster. Okay? And that's the main thing. Okay? That's the mystical power. There's no magic to it, right? It's plain old projections, like everything else. Right? It works. Because it's a projection. Okay? All right, we're going to take a break and come back and do the 12-point Lojong in 10 minutes. So come back at 9:20. Okay? There's a drinking fountain out here on the right, okay? It's legal. Say Lojong.
Lojong.
Namke.
Namke.
Kima.
Kima.
Lojong.
Lojong.
Namke.
Namke.
Kima.
Kima.
Lojong means Lojong. Aha. Namka means, it can either mean sky or the space, you know, like the night sky. It can mean that. The Abhidharma says, Namke, what's it say? Namke Pugao. It's supposed to be one of the things that doesn't change, but anyway, that's another story. Kim means the 12 houses of the astrology is called Kim. In Tibetan also it's called Kim. Kim means celestial mansions or something like that. Like the house of Capricorn or the house of... There are also 12 in... Okay. Don't stare at her, okay? Kima means... what do you call it? House, right? The house of the astrological house. There are also 12. I think it all came from Persia anyway. Okay. It also reached Tibet. And there's very beautiful Tibetan astrological scriptures from the Kangyur and Tengyur, in the Tengyur, like from very many centuries ago. Ma is the normal ending for a text, okay? So it's the Lojong of the houses of the constellation, of the houses of the sky or something like that. And this is one of those things like in Tibetan where they have code words for numbers, like Chokdon Dawa, if you know the Dakye. That's about how many kiriams there are. Because there are chokchu, right? 10 choks, and the dawa is one. So there are kirim chukchik, is called chokdon dawa. It's a code word. Namke kima is a code word for the number 12. Because there are 12 houses of the, you know, what do you call it? Houses of the heavens, right? Okay? Like that. And this is a lojong where they're describing, it's a short one, it's a few verses. And they're describing the 12 spiritual qualities of a person who has succeeded in the Lojong, who has reached the goals of Lojong. And they tend to exhibit 12 kinds of behavior. Okay. And it's a very short list, and we'll go through the 12. I'm just going to write them in in the pronunciation. You can see it in the reading, okay? First one is called Yiche. The verse says Yiche Rungdang Karinden Mi La Rogdang Kun La Jam Shen La Che Chen Shink Ten Du Nyandam Zunga Ten. Okay, that's the first verse. Yiche means like Yiche means you can count on them. Okay, like a person who has studied Lojong well, if they make you a commitment, you can count on them. You know, whatever they say they're going to do for you, they do for you. Okay, like they're totally trustworthy. They don't let people down. In an ultimate sense, they don't let down their mothers and fathers. Who's that? All living beings. Okay, like you can trust them. But even in little things, like during the day, you can trust them. They give you, they make a commitment to do something for you. They volunteer for some project at their Dharma center. You can count on them. They finish it. Okay. Got in then. Okay, I'll try. I'm trying to fit 12 on this page. That's all. But I'll try. Say Kadin.
Ten.
Kadin means kindness. Den means to remember, and Kadin Den means a person who remembers kindness in the sense that once something has done something for them, they don't forget it and they remain loyal to that person. You see, what that person needs. If the person who has paid them great kindness needs something, they continue to be there for them. You see? That's what Kadin Den means. And this is especially as your Buddhist practice gets better and better, you will feel this towards your teachers and towards your fellow students. And this is a barometer of your practice. Okay? If you start to feel these intense feelings of thank you, and feeling like having a relationship to the teacher or to your other students, then it's a sign that you are getting it, you know, that you're succeeding. The sweeter your Dharma gets, the more you'll feel some kind of gratitude or loyalty to that tradition and to that teaching. You see what I mean? It's a very sweet feeling. If you don't have it much, it means you're not getting the results. And if you start having it more and more, it's a good sign. So I'm not saying artificially try to feel it. I'm just saying if someone saves your life, you feel like that about them. You know, if you're as amazing things start to happen to you, you will treasure that the place where you got those things. So it's a sign that your practice is going well. Okay. Say Mila.
Mila.
Ro.
Ro.
Mila.
Mila.
Rok. Mila means to people. Rok means to help. It means helpful. This is like Jhampa behavior, okay? I mean, you go down to Howell. I'm teaching the class. He's really doing it, right? I think he should teach the class. Sometime we should get him down here, right? Up here. Anyway, helpful to everybody. I mean, every time you see something who needs the slightest bit of help, you are off your ass and you're over there near them helping them. You know what I mean? Two signs of a person who's not like that. They either got their hands in their pocket or they're sitting down. This is like very typical. I mean, Mila Rok, a person whose Lojong is good, is like always moving, you know? Like, they're the first ones to stand up when the bell rings. You know, they're the one who says, I'll go out and get the thing. You know, they're the one who's jumping up. They're always in motion to help. As soon as it's clear that somebody needs something, they're up and they're helping. You know, their hands are out and they're ready to help. Like they're constantly in a state of readiness, you know, red alert to be helpful to people. And anytime someone needs something, they're there and they're really, what do you call it? Substantial help, okay? It's not like, you know, do you need anything? Like I got like 10 minutes, you know? You know, it's not like that, you know? I mean, when you really need it, they're there and they're not watching the time. and they're really helping you, okay? And they're giving you help that means something, okay? It says kun la jam. Say kun la jam.
Kun la jam.
Kun la means to everybody. Jam, this is the jam in Jambayang, if you know Jambayang in Sanskrit, Manjushri. Manju means soft or gentle or friendly. It's the word used for cotton balls in Tibetan, okay? It's this, it's a kind of a softness or a gentleness to everybody. It's like being friendly to everyone. Like, as they go throughout New York, as they walk down the street, they're always like relating to people. You know, all day long they're relating to people. They're just friendly to everybody automatically. And why not? We're all dying together, you know? We're all in the act of dying. Why not be nice to each other, you know what I mean? We got a few years or months to be here. You know, might as well be friendly to each other. Why? And suppose you don't feel well or you're not having a good day or the boss just yelled at. Well, who cares? Still be friendly to people. What's the point? We're all dying. You know, be friendly to each other. What do you got to lose, right? Doesn't hurt. Doesn't cost you anything, right? And that's a sign of successful lojo. Just friendly, okay? Say, Shenla.
Shenla.
Tell Chen.
Tell
Chen. Shenla.
Shenla.
Tell Chen.
Tell Chen.
Shenla means to other people. Tell, I think you remember, you had Tell Yue and Bak Yue. I'm sorry, Tell Yue and... What's the other one? Ngotsa, okay. Tell Yue means in your behavior you are sensitive to what other people will think as you take certain actions. That's called Tell Yue. Tell Chen means you're very sensitive. Chen means big. Shenla Tell Chen means you're constantly courteous to other people. And frankly, this is a sign of a good Buddhist. I mean, the people who really do well with their Buddhist practice are constantly being courteous to other people. And it's not something that they talk about much in the teachings. This is Lojong stuff, okay? Lojong, you don't see it much in the... I mean, it's there in the Lamrim Chemo. You have to know where to look. But being courteous to other people is just a very, very basic Buddhist thing. You know, you see Seamus showing up with 12 handfuls of equipment, you stop and help him. You know what I mean? And you be courteous to each other. You know, somebody needs a seat, you give it up for him, you know, or her. You know, somebody needs a homework, you take care of them. And you just act towards each other and towards other people in a courteous way. You know, it's thoughtful. And this should be like very natural for a bodhisattva. You know, it's very weird and it's very much a sign of a failure of Dharma classes. This center is a failure. These classes are a failure. Forget this big high bodhisattva behavior of giving up your body for others. If you can't even hold a door open for somebody, or you can't help Seamus carry the stuff here, or you don't want to stay 5 minutes over and clean up, or something like that, then how are you ever going to give up your arm or your eye or your, you know, what are you talking about? You know, and you say, oh, there's no connection. You bet there's a connection, okay? That courteous, being courteous is the first step of being a bodhisattva. Come on, you know what I mean? It's very weird, and I've been in Dharma groups where they just trash the place. You know, 5 minutes after they leave, there's 2 hours of work left for the monks usually, or the nuns, and that's like the least courteous thing you can imagine. You know, that's the opposite of bodhisattva behavior. I mean, basic courteous behavior towards other people is that's like the first thousandth of a percent of a bodhisattva behavior. You know what I mean? You're going to have to give up your eyeball for these people. You don't have 5 minutes to help clean the floor. You know, what are you talking about? The high bodhisattva activities start by normal, courteous behavior towards other people. You know, and that's all. Don't throw stuff on the ground. You know, don't break something on the subway. You know, don't spit where somebody might step in it or put the gum there. Stuff like that. This is like, if you can't do that, what are you talking about, bodhisattva, Mahayana, all this stuff? You know, what are you talking about? You know, you can't even think that someone might step in the gum or you know, that somebody has to clean the floor after you leave, you know, and you just leave everything on. What is that? What does it mean? You see what I mean? It means that teaching is a failure, that, you know, 5 years of studying Buddhist scripture is a failure. You know, you haven't even started. You can't even be courteous to other people. That's weird. It's just weird. Weird Dharma. I've seen it a lot. In America, it's very common, you know. like the last people that would ever help you clean up a place are Dharma students, you know. They always got to get home and recite something, you know. You know what I mean? It's weird. I'd like to help you. I got to go meditate, you know. On what? Oh, exchanging self and others, you know. You know. Well, could you just exchange your time for some mopping tonight, you know? It's like, let's not like be like that, okay? This Lojong is very basic and very true. You know, I'm embarrassed when that happens in my center, you know, where I am. It really embarrasses me, you know. I feel like I'm a failure, you know. Anyway, there it is. Courteous. Think about other people. I mean, basically. I mean, what's this talking about Bodhisattva if you can't even think about other people that much, you know? I see people come into Rinpoche, they clean out his refrigerator. This is your root lama. This is the head of the Tantric College in Lhasa, Tibet in 1959. You know, this is the highest living scholar of Buddhism in the world. You know, and you're in there raiding his refrigerator, you know, and leaving his house in a mess, you know, and peeing all over the ground and stuff, and not even lifting the seat, you know. I mean, what is that? He has to come in and clean it, you know. I mean, think about it. This is just plain old common courtesy, you know. And it's amazing. It's pretty amazing, actually. Okay, anyway. Shengi Den. Say Shengi.
Shengi.
Ten.
Ten.
Shengi.
Shengi.
Ten.
Ten.
Shen means other people's. Den means foot servant or something like that. It's not quite slave, okay, but it's very close in Tibetan. And in the Lama Chepa, you know, in these high holy prayers, Bodhisattva, people who take Bodhisattva vows are always saying, I pledge to be Shengi Den now, you know. I am the slave of others. Anything you want, ask me. I'm at your command. It's like saying, I'm at your command, you know. But once you've taken Bodhisattva vows, the first set, right? Remember there's two kinds of Bodhisattva vows? Once you have sworn to have the attitude of a Bodhisattva, you are at the command of all other people. You know, whatever they need, you are thinking, you're being kind to them all the time. You know, you're being kind to other people all the time. And that's just plain Bodhisattva behavior, okay? You are at their command. What they need, you give kindly, okay? Kindness, plain old kindness. You also see these people say, I got to get home, meditate. I can't help this person who's about to commit suicide and having a breakdown, you know. I'm busy. I have a computer project. We're inputting all the scriptures to teach you how to be kind, you know. Could you come back later, you know? Maybe I do that. Okay, anyway. Seven. Say duor. Nian. Tulwa. Nian. Dulwa is the past tense of dulwa. Dulwa, as you may know, means Vinaya, okay? Dulwa means... The word Vinaya, by the way, means a practice for taming your mind or taming your behavior. Dulwa is a verb that's used for wild horses and stuff like that. Did you dulwa the horse? Yeah, yeah, I rode him for 5 minutes. He finally stopped bucking. That's called dulwa, okay? Dulwa is the past tense. Dulwa means to be tame, to be gentle, to listen in a respectful and controlled way. Nyen means to listen to what your lama asks you to do and things like that, okay? In a very respectful way. And it's also a good habit with other people. You know, it's very common of bodhisattvas to listen carefully to what they're being asked to do, okay? Like it's a kind of humility to be obedient when you should be, okay? It doesn't mean to be obedient when they're asking you to do something wrong or to hurt somebody. It doesn't mean that. But it means when a lama has a very sweet, beautiful, helpful instruction asking you to do something, then you say, you know, with gladness I do it, and of course I'll do it. And then you go and you execute it for that lama or for that group or whatever, okay? And that's called duor nyen, okay? Nyen means to listen or to obey. Rinpoche often tells me that Droma listens to me, to him better than I do, okay? That's called Nyen, okay? His dog, okay? Say Dzumkar?
Dzumkar.
Chen.
Chen.
Dzumkar?
Dzumkar.
Chen.
Chen.
Those of you know Ganden Hagyama, this is found there also. Something like this, Dzumkar Chen. Smiling face, okay? Dzum means honorific for teeth, I think. Oh, smile. Gar means white. Dzungkar Chen means, you know, like, you know, always like Jampa, okay, down in Howell. I mean, always cheerful. Never seen him in a bad mood. I've lived with him for 5 years or something. Never seen him be less than cheerful. Never. And I know he has backaches. I know he has migraines. I know he stays up till 2 in the morning cleaning up after those bodhisattvas, after sechus and other ceremonies. And I've never seen him be grumpy or bitter or anything. Always cheerful. You know, always cheerful. Okay. Why not? You know, what else are you going to do? So, cheerful is important. Cheerful is a very common bodhisattva behavior. Never seen him personally. I've never seen him complain, actually, ever. Never once. You know, that's cheerful. Okay. No complaining. No kvetching. Okay. Yeah. I think it's very close. But in Buddhism, joyful has the connotations of enjoying good karma. And cheerful is more like, especially in the face of adversity, or in the face of bodhisattvas who can't clean the floor, cheerful. And you don't like always complaining about it and whining about it. Cheerful, never whining, never complaining, never kvetching. Ultimately, everything that takes place in your world was designed by one person alone. And you might as well grin and bear it and change it, okay? Number 9. We're on page 18 now. Yeah. Excuse me? I think, yeah, a little bit. No, I can't. Must be a bhakchak from my past life. Seriously? Something like that. I mean, I went to Cub Scouts and all, you know. Seriously? Maybe the lineage got here before I knew about it. I don't know. Let's see. It's exactly like that? That's funny. Okay, anyway. It's probably just a coincidence. Say Tunze. Bakya. Tunze. Bakya. That's weird. Tun means in common, like Tumon Lanjan Nuda Gyupana, you know, common path. Zay means things that people share in common, like the environment, like the world, okay? Bakya is a special expression in Vinaya. And Bakya means, for example, we can't waste food in Vinaya. Like it's against the monk's vow not to finish your bowl of food. You have to eat it all. You know, and you never waste food. You never waste resources of humanity. And that's thrifty. That's like Tenzei Bakya means, you know, do not waste. For your children, don't waste the resources of this planet. Don't waste food. Don't waste other things. You know, this is where Rinpoche, it's very bodhisattva behavior to go around the room. He comes down every night and turns off the lights. You know, every time he can, he turns off the heat. He turns off the air conditioning. He turns off things all the time. He goes around the house turning off things. He goes around the house never buying things that he doesn't need. I mean, if you've been in his room, if you've watched him, he never wastes, ever, you know. And he could, and people would give him money. If he needed money, we would give it. He never wastes. He always is. Bakya means mindful of the needs of others, mindful of common resources. And this is a kind of bodhisattva behavior, even with our planet, you know. This is like, don't waste the riches of this planet, okay. They are here because of your karma. You created the material wealth of the United States of America. You can be proud of it. But if you waste it, you can be sure you won't have it again. You see what I mean? It will not exist in the future for you. Okay? And common resources were created by being mindful not to waste what everyone could use. You see what I mean? That's called Tunze Bakya. Say pata. Then. Pata.
Then.
Ba is a word for warrior. Like, really the word bodhisattva, the sattva part in Tibetan is sempa. Chanju sempa. And this ba means warrior. Brave person. Tak means the sign of a warrior. Patak then means possesses the sign of courage. It means brave. Okay. This is especially in the sense of your worldview. Okay. You are not afraid to take a stand or to take a view or to live a life for which you will be criticized by other people. You know what I mean? But you know it's right. You know it's the right thing to do. And you're brave enough to stand by it. Okay? You have courage in the sense of you know a certain worldview is correct. And you know, if you really keep a pure Buddhist worldview, you probably will be drawn into some kind of friction with the way the world works. You know, you'll be accused of something if you keep your Buddhist worldview. And if especially if you practice higher practices or whatever, you will be criticized. And you have to be strong enough to, in your beliefs and in your understanding of karma, to do the right thing. I think Gandhi was really good at this. You know, Gandhi didn't mind to get beat up or kicked or literally physically beaten in a moment. You know, at any given moment he was ready to be physically beaten. You know, you and I see something going on the street that's not right. We keep our mouths shut because the guy might have a gun or a knife. And I imagine that Gandhi would just walk up to the guy and say, why are you throwing that stuff on the ground, you know? That makes everybody's house dirty, you know? And you'd probably get hit on the head for it. You see what I mean? And you just, I mean, philosophically, as a Buddhist, you have to be willing to stand up and say, this thing is crazy. You know, we have to stop this thing. This kind of behavior is not acceptable. Or this kind of worldview is stupid. And I'm stopping that. I won't do that anymore. And people will call you crazy or silly or dirty or whatever. And you stand up for it. Okay? That's courage. Yeah?
How does that work in obedience?
I think obedience is in the case of a... Normally when you're not obedient, in that sense, it's to some goodness that you know you should do and that you agree that you should do and that you know is good for you. I had this sweet letter this morning from this sweet student in California. I love you. I believe everything you taught. I'm going to give up my job and come to New York and study with you next year. And by the way, I'm not keeping my book and I'm not meditating. You know, seriously, I got this letter this morning. Beautiful card. Beautiful picture on the front, you know. I'm talking about obedience in the sense of doing what you know is good for you and just lazy or some kind of unwillingness to do what's clearly right, you know. Okay, number 11. Say, dakshin, so, dakshin, so. Dak means pure, okay, dak means pure. Shing means field. Field. So means to create or to make. Okay? Dakshin so means to make your own Buddha field. Okay? To make your pure field. Pure land, they call it. Okay? It's a translation of this, dakshin. Okay? Dakshin means paradise, Buddhist paradise. Okay? One of the main karmas to help create a Buddha paradise in your future is plain old cleanliness. Okay, and I know I have a very dirty room, so I'm not too good at it. Okay, and it doesn't mean to be anal about it. It doesn't mean that, but it means that, you know, it's conducive to your meditation. It's conducive to a good state of mind to have a nice, simple room, nice, simple place to live. Throw out all the junk, you know. Throw out the things that don't matter. And it doesn't have to be Gucci furniture or whatever. You know what I mean? Not like that. And it doesn't have to be, you know... I used to go to these people's houses when I was a kid and they would have these nice, beautiful plush carpets and they would cover them with this horrible, sticky plastic because they didn't want it to get dirty and you couldn't even see it, you know? And not like that, okay? But just, you know, the idea of a Buddhist is poor, simple, and clean and neat. You know what I mean? That the place where you live... the place, especially the place where you meditate, is nice. It's sweet. It's simple. Okay, and I'm not either saying sort of a compulsion or addiction to ultimate simplicity, you know, where you take care that the whole room is stark or something. I don't mean that. I mean it's comfortable, it's friendly, it's warm, and it's neat and clean. Something like that, okay? Something like that. Your dress is not fancy, but it's clean and it's neat. Something like that, okay? And that in Buddhism is called preparing your Buddha feel. Okay, that's a code word for next to godliness. All right. Last one is called Say Chösem. Shul. Chösem. Shul. Chö means Dharma. Sem means mind. Chösem means a Dharma state of mind. Okay. Shul means, Shul is a beautiful word. It means you lost yourself to that. Like Shul is a word for throwing water out of a pot. It's like, how do you say? It means like the stream is going along and you're swept along with the stream. You see what I mean? Chösem Shul means your mind is carried away in the current of the Dharma. And it means that you're a spiritual person. You have, all day long, you're thinking spiritually. That's called Chösem Shul. You have lost yourself to Dharma. You know, people would say you're almost fanatical or something. Fanatical to me means, you know, you bother other people. Not like that. You're just totally immersed in it all the time. You spend your whole day happily in Dharma. And that's called Chösem Shul. So it's trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. Okay. A 12-point lojong. It was kind of cool when I realized that it fit those 12. You know, I was pretty freaked out. I thought maybe, you know, 800 years ago some guy is writing it, you know, and is it coincidence? You know, is it some kind of coincidence or something, you know? She said, can you think of it as a bodhisattva started the Boy Scouts? Okay? Answer is this. It's the last question on your homework. That's how I get people to pay attention. And that also get them to know that we're almost done with class. So they probably listened for the last 2 minutes, okay? I call it Dharma revisionism, okay? Dharma revisionism. Revisionism to me means where you rewrite history, right? Like if you're American, you rewrite the Cold War in a certain way. The Russians started it. When I got to Russia, it was very cool. You know, I studied Russian for years and years. I finally went to Russia a few years ago. And I lived with those guys for a couple of days. We worked together. We had a beautiful time. And I got in the car and I said, they said, how do you like Russia? You know, and I said, you guys are wonderful. And to tell you the truth, when I was growing up, they made us get under the desks every month. They rang an alarm, and I had to get under the desk. And I said, they said, why? And I said, because they told me that you evil Russians were going to attack us with atom bombs, and you were these horrible monsters, and you hated us, and you were trying to kill us. And they taught us that over and over and over again. I thought the first time I met a Russian, I'd probably get some kind of virus or something, you know. And I said, you guys are great. You're just like we are, you know. We had a great time. And they said, I'll tell you something. They told us the same thing about you. You know, and this is revisionism. You see, in my mind, I rewrote my life's history. On that moment, in the car, I remember it was like Nevsky Prospekt or something in St. Petersburg, you know. It's Naberski Prospect, you know, it's a certain street. I remember the street. On that moment, I rewrote the history of my life. You know, I canceled everything Mrs. Melvin told me about the Russians. You know what I mean? Everything was just changed. I rewrote the history of my life. And what I'm trying to say is, as you get older, as your Dharma practice gets better, you will want to look into a revisionism of your past, of your earlier life. Okay? People are always coming to me and telling me, oh, when I was 23, I read such and such a book. And then I got changed into a Buddhist, you know. Then I met my first Lama. You know, and what I'm trying to say is that as you get older and older, as your practice gets more powerful, you will start to have Namdak. Say Namdak.
Namdak.
Namdak is an experience, a spiritual level, where you begin to realize that the people who brought you up were not normal beings. Okay? The early people in your life, your Boy Scout patrol leader, okay? Your first high school boyfriend, okay? Your own parents, your sister, the one you hated, okay? Were they special beings or normal people? You will start to wonder, and that's a good sign, okay? Because don't think Buddhas can't appear as your sister you didn't like, okay? Don't think Buddhas can't appear as Boy Scout leaders. Don't think the guy who started the Boy Scouts couldn't have been a Kadampa Geshe. You know what I mean? Don't ever think that. You know, it's called Dharma revisionism, okay? At some point in your practice, you may want to rewrite your childhood. Okay? Who knows who those people were? Okay? Can you really tell me? People say, no, they didn't have slanty eyes. They couldn't have been Tibetan deities, you know? Come on, you think Tara can't appear as your sister? You know, you think Manjushri has a problem? Maitreya can't appear as a dog, but did to his Sangha? You know, you think that your Boy Scout leader could not have been a Lama, a real Lama, a Tibetan Buddhist Lama who could emanate? You know, do you think the guy who wrote the 12 points of the Boy Scout code or something, it's impossible that they could have been a Bodhisattva or a Buddha, you know? Do you believe that? Then you didn't get to this stage yet, okay? And what I'm saying is that I'm suggesting you go back. This week's meditation, go back and check out the important people in your life, the people who made a difference. For me, it was Mr. Bloom in the fifth grade. You know, put my life on a different track. You know, it was a certain person in the 11th grade that really made me a monk. You know, if I look back, it was that crucial year. It was that particular month. Are you sure that they were not some kind of extraordinary bodhisattva? Are you sure? You know, do it. Think about it logically. Do this meditation logically. Okay? Are you sure that that person who affected you was not an emanation of a holy being? You know, and you go back and you check. Those of you who had logic course last semester, you try to do it logically, okay? Give me a dak yang dak, you know, give me a jorwa. Chechen, yinte, mayin becha, you know? Try to prove to me that they weren't. You know, you try to prove to me that any influential person in your life was not a high bodhisattva. You try to prove to me that the Boy Scout Code wasn't written by a high lama, who was really a high lama, you know? And by the way, explore the question, could they be both? Explore the question, could they have been both? Get it? Okay? Explore the question that as your own spiritual life begins to reach its success point and you start to escape death itself, that you can revise what you were perceiving of them. And will it be valid? You know, were they normal or were they bodhisattvas out to help you? You know? You know, are they either? Are they both? Are they validly one or the other? Am I just trying to be metaphorical? Am I just saying, oh, you could look at them that way? No, I'm not. Okay? I'm saying, could they have been tantric deities sent to help you? You know? Okay? This won't come out on the tape. I'm waving a pen. Same pen. Okay. All right. We'll do a prayer. Sanghe Shindu Mithe Guwahi Jogo Namdha.
This is the end of Class 7. You have been listening to Lojong, Developing the Good Heart with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.